From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. Now to the debate over health care. In a few minutes, we're going to hear from two doctors who've been practicing for more than 30 years about how the system has changed in that time. First, to one idea that's been floating around Capitol Hill, health care co-ops.
Co-ops have several ardent boosters there, among them Democratic Senator Kent Conrad of North Dakota. Co-ops would be an alternative to a government-run health insurance plan. That's what the administration prefers, and it's an idea that's been met with a lot of skepticism on Capitol Hill. There already are a handful of healthcare co-ops around the country, so the institution has a track record. NPR's Joanne Silberner visited one of the oldest to see how it works.
Hi, George.
Amy. Hi, dear.
How are you?
I'm fine.
Good.
George Fell has stopped by a pharmacy in a suburb of Minneapolis. It's owned and run by a nonprofit health insurance co-op called Health Partners.
Any questions with anything?
Nope.
Okay. And just slide through when you get a chance.
He's picking up five prescriptions today for himself and his wife.
Receipt's in your bag.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a great day. Thank you.
Bye.
See you later, George.
Fell has been a member of Health Partners for 27 years.
I like my pharmacy and I like my doctor and I don't want to change.
Fell says he doesn't think much about Health Partners being an unusual type of insurance company. But it is, says board member Jack Garrity.
You own it and you operate it and you use it and you get the benefits from it.
You own it means the 1.25 million people who have Health Partners insurance, mostly Minnesotans, own the company. They vote for directors like Jack Garrity from among their members. And the board of directors selects the CEO, at the moment Mary Brainerd. Brainerd says one of the special features of Health Partners is how it handles complaints.
Our dissatisfied members have recourse to a committee of our board directly to resolve any issues that they have with the organization.
Tom Brinscoe is chairman of the board, and he's been on more than a dozen appeals panels. He remembers one issue in particular. A couple was trying to conceive a child. They'd used up all the fertility treatments allowed under their plan.
I'll just never forget how sincere and how much they wanted a child and just were not having the success that they desired. The committee really struggled with that. And quite frankly, we overruled.
They got the extra session. Members don't always get what they want. There are denials, too. The bottom line is, unlike the case with for-profit or standard nonprofit insurers, co-op members really control the company. They could even kick out CEO Mary Brainerd if they didn't like her policies.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Yeah, they could.
CEO Brainerd says her company is in the black and plows profits back into things like electronic health records. It saves money with its lower administrative costs, 6%, half that of the average private insurer, and by focusing on preventive care. Co-op approach has fans among health economists such as Karen Davis, who heads the Commonwealth Fund.
The co-op system can make a difference. It is making a difference in those areas where they currently exist. It'll take a long time to get there more broadly in the nation, but we have models of care that currently work.
She says they'll need help, seed money to start with, and some way to guarantee low doctor and hospital fees, maybe a national board. That's where some Republican legislators and free marketeers get nervous. Michael Tanner with the Libertarian Cato Institute says there's nothing intrinsically bad about co-ops as long as the government is not involved. His nightmare for co-ops is this.
Washington's appointing the directors and officers where it is subsidized by the taxpayers, where Congress directs the way it practices insurance. And I don't think free market people would support it.
But that's not Senator Conrad's vision. He wants the plans to be owned and run by members, not by the government. That question about how much the government should be involved is at the center of not just the co-op issue, but the entire debate over redesigning the healthcare system. Joanne Silberner, NPR News.
A new day is dawning in Europe for misshapen fruits and vegetables. The European Union has rescinded some 20-year-old regulations that protected European grocery shoppers from the sight of bendy cucumbers, knobbly carrots, puny cauliflowers, naked onions, and assorted other offenses to the European eye. It has evidently been a pillar of EU food regs that ugly produce is unworthy of the marketplace, and they've been throwing out a lot of nutritious but unsightly food ever since. Well, joining us to talk about this is Diana Henry, who is food columnist for the Sunday Telegraph and also host of her own TV cooking show. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
And what do you make of ugly produce dereg?
I am thrilled. Honestly, here it is 32 degrees today. That's in the 90s, which probably seems kind of low for you, but here we're sweltering. The economy is going to hell in a handcart. And now we know that we can actually use the knobbly fruit and vegetables that we've kind of like missed and loved. So they're back. I think it's great. I'm just sorry that they've taken regulations away from 26 fruit and vegetables, but there are still 10 that are going to be very much scrutinized. And I would quite like it if they could all be kind of deregged as well.
And the ones that are still to be regulated, they're not minor vegetables. We're talking about apples and citrus and kiwi and lettuce.
They still have to be 50 millimeters in diameter to be considered a true apple. And it's things like citrus fruit, peaches and nectarines. I think what's a pity about that is it's like bureaucrats are telling us what's a perfect peach. And I think a perfect peach is actually a very elusive thing, and it doesn't always have to do with how it looks at all.
But tell me the truth. If you're doing your cooking show on television,
yes,
and you have the choice to use a cucumber that's fairly straight or one that looks like a green knockwurst, you're going to pick the one that looks better, aren't you?
You're right. I kind of am part of that thing, I suppose, because when I do the cooking show, the vegetables and the fruit look perfect. That continues that kind of notion that that's the way they should look. But they will not necessarily be the ones that taste good.
But without holding you to account for the thinking of the European Commission, what was the idea behind banning the forked, multi-rooted carrot? What was seen as the problem there?
I just think in Brussels they're quite bored and they don't know what to do with their time. But I have to say the problem in Britain with this is that we seem to me to be quite law-abiding. I go to France and I go to Portugal and they don't care what shape their tomatoes are and they don't care what shape their cucumbers are. They seem to think, well, they're just laws and we'll break them. That's quite the Mediterranean spirit in a way. But in Britain, we tend to slavishly follow them.
Well, Diana Henry, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
That's Diana Henry, food columnist for the Sunday Telegraph newspaper in London. And one rule that has not changed, according to the European Commission, is this. The bend of a banana must be, and I quote, the thickness of a transverse section of the fruit between the lateral faces and the middle, perpendicular to the longitudinal axis, must be at a minimum of 27 millimeters, which is 1.06 inches.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Supreme Court ended its term yesterday with a decision that limits what public employers may do to achieve racial diversity in the workplace. In a 5-4 vote, the court overturned a lower court ruling that had allowed the city of New Haven, Connecticut, to throw out the results of a promotion exam for firefighters after only white firefighters scored high enough to be promoted. We're hearing different views of that ruling and its potential impact on this morning's program. And joining us now for some analysis is NPR's Juan Williams. Good morning.
Good morning, Renee.
Let's begin with the question of how far-reaching this decision will be. Do you think it marks a turning point when it comes to efforts to achieve racial diversity in the workplace?
Yeah, I think I do, Renee. It's going to be tougher for employers now. The ruling will create important changes in the rules of civil rights law. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, in reading a dissent from the bench yesterday, said the damage will be untold in undermining civil rights law, specifically the Civil Rights Act and Title VII, the promise of protection against employment criteria that produce results skewed in favor of one race or another. So employers, especially public sector employers, I think, are going to have a much tougher time achieving diversity. And they likely will less likely, I should say, to make an effort absent any litigation. So I think that takes away a lot of the energy that once surrounded affirmative action in the country.
Well, then, does the decision mean that those protections of Title VII of the Civil Rights Act are weakened across the board?
Well, I think they are weakened, Renee, because if you think of it, affirmative action, as it was understood under Title VII, under the law, really was spurring employers to promote equal opportunity or diversity of their workforce. For example, in the New Haven firefighters case, New Haven feared that it failed to appropriately consider disparate impact after a test result showed that no blacks were eligible for promotion on the basis of their test. The high court has now heightened the standards to the point that employers with all white hires or promotions have to keep that test and keep those promotions in place although the test may not be relevant to the job. So it's going to be harder for cities to throw out any test, even if it results in promotion of all whites, for example.
And Juan, some time ago, former Justice Sandra Day O'Connor said she thought affirmative action had about 25 years to stand before courts began striking it down as no longer necessary. Do you think now that she was right about that?
I do, Renee. Justice O'Connor made that comment after the University of Michigan cases decided by the Supreme Court in 2003. Then the Supreme Court ruled that race could be one of several factors taken into account by school admissions personnel, but not reduced to a quota or a numerical advantage for any one group. Now, yesterday's ruling takes this one step farther. Justice Antonin Scalia said he now sees a war between disparate impact and equal protection under the civil rights law. Previously, I think both were seen as advancing efforts to prevent employment discrimination. But now, you know, in a world in which you have a large number of women in the workplace, large number of minorities, I think this is now seen in Scalia's mind as providing protection for white men in the workplace. So that puts employers in a tougher position in terms of advancing diversity.
Juan, thanks.
You're welcome, Renee.
NPR News analyst Juan Williams on yesterday's Supreme Court ruling in favor of white firefighters in New Haven, Connecticut. The firefighters sued over the city's decision to throw out the results of a promotion exam because only white firefighters scored high enough to be promoted.
Now, a review of a new book of short stories from a writer who won major critical acclaim last year. Aravind Adiga's debut novel, The White Tiger, won the Man Booker Prize. His new collection is called Between the Assassinations. Alan Chews has this review.
The book's dozen or so stories take place between the political killings of Indira Gandhi and her son Rajiv. That's not a broad swath of time, from 1984 to 1991. The setting isn't all that broad a swath of India, either. Adiga focuses on a rather small plot of earth, Kittur, a forested town with Hindu temples and Catholic churches near the Arabian Sea. Just 6 years in a small town, a length of time that Adiga reduces even further by using the metaphor of touring the entire town in 6 days. It's in the hearts of his characters where Adiga reveals great depth and breadth, spanning the ages from youth to late maturity and giving us a range of people whose caste affiliations and immediate aspirations for their lives rank from the highest to the lowest. Ziauddin, small and black, with baby fat in his cheeks, is a Muslim boy who finds work in a number of couture shops, only to steal wherever he goes. Xerox, who sells pirated books, including a copy of the Satanic Verses, is the son of the lowest of the low waste collectors. Half Brahmin, his father, half low caste, his mother, the rich but confused Shankara sets off a bomb at his school and suffers the consequences. George D'Souza, who sprays mosquito repellent for a living, comes under the sway of a rich young foreign Christian woman and hopes, right up to the moment when he oversteps certain boundaries, to change his life. Like Murali, the aging fiction writer turned political agitator in the last story, we're reminded of that strange mixture of the strikingly beautiful and the filthy, which is the nature of every Indian village, and maybe also in some places we've lived in, right here at home.
Our reviewer is Alan Chews. The collection of short stories by Aravind Adiga is called Between the Assassinations.
Even as Los Angeles struggles through financial woes, one of the biggest stories is still the death of Michael Jackson last week. And even as his family mourns their loss, they have to sort through all of the King of Pop's legal and financial mess. And experts say it could take years. Estimates have his debt somewhere between $400 and $500 million. There's his Neverland Ranch, which featured an amusement park and a zoo that cost millions to maintain. Reports also suggest he burned through additional millions in whimsical shopping sprees. And then there were the legal entanglements, lawsuits that cost him millions in judgments and legal fees. All of this leaves many Americans wondering, how could one man burn through such a large fortune? And how can the rest of us avoid these mistakes? Here to talk about all this is our money coach, our personal finance expert, Alvin Hall, who has been traveling the world but is finally back here with us. Welcome back, Alvin. Good to talk to you.
I'm very glad to be here today, Michelle.
Well, at one point, Michael Jackson was the biggest star in the world. I think that's fair to say. His career spanned 40 years. He grossed, it is believed, about $1 billion. So how is it possible that he could wind up with nothing, or that his heirs, rather, could wind up with nothing?
Well, I think they're actually going to wind up with something, but at this moment, he's probably pretty much on the negative side. That's because he spent his future. He was once a huge pop star who could just go out and generate huge amounts of cash. And with that, he started to spend. And like many people, if somebody told you no when you're earning $1 billion, you say, oh, that person doesn't know how much money I have. They don't understand me. They don't understand how I generate money. And Michael Jackson would fire them and bring in a new team. Then he would fire that one and bring in another team. So eventually, he surrounded himself with people who were largely financial enablers. They would let him spend whatever he wanted.
So it's just a simple math. I mean, it doesn't matter how much money you have if you spend more than you earn.
Exactly.
That's how it is. It's how it
is.
So that's, in a way, it's a cautionary tale for the rest of us. But I do want to say, you know, we've talked a lot about how shrewd a businessman he was. Many point to his purchase of the Beatles catalog in 1985. He bought it for $47.5 million at the time, but it provided millions in annual income. And then he sold Sony a stake in the catalog a couple of years back. He reportedly pocketed $95 million just for a stake. So I guess the question one would have is, if you're so smart about those kinds of decisions, right, how is it that you could still make poor decisions that would cost you on the other end? I mean, can you just add some insight there?
Yes. I think if you watch the Martin Bashir special, where in less than 6 minutes or whatever that time frame was, he spent $6 million on what was tchotchkes. I mean, it wasn't even stuff of good taste. I think Michael just led a life where if he wanted a private jet and it cost $40,000 to charter it or $500,000, it made no difference because he never really did the numbers. He never subtracted numbers. All he saw was the money coming in. And I think that's what happens to people when all of a sudden they have unbelievable wealth. You see this again and again with movie stars, especially with rap musicians or any type of pop music star. They have this burst of fame. They think it's going to go on forever and ever and ever. And they forget. All you have to do is look around and you see that everybody's careers goes through cycles. So you need to prepare for the down period. And Michael didn't cut back.
Well, what's the relevance for the rest of us? Let's bring it down to where the rest of us live, which is not in the world of private jets, at least not me. I don't know. Maybe you. You've been gone. I don't know. Maybe you're jetting
around. Oh, that Cessna in Africa.
Fabulous,
yeah, with me in a bush pilot.
You know, Learjets,
that was pretty...
But
for the average person, what it says is when you're earning good money, you need to stash it away, which Michael did. But then you need to cut your cloth to fit your earnings. Just because you were once earning this huge amount of money doesn't mean you're doing it today. So you need to dial back a little. And Michael clearly did not dial back. And the other lesson, especially when you're earning serious money like that, you need to have very prudent, wise financial advisors around you. My grandmother used to always have this really odd statement, and I never really understood it until in recent years. You need to always have friends in your life who will tell you that your breath stinks. So what Michael needed was somebody in his life to tell him that he was overspending. But
who's that person going to be? I mean, generally, the people who you're surrounded by at that level are people who are earning their income off of you.
But you can also find people, as many of my friends who are in the entertainment industry have done, people who will be honest with you, who will tell you how much you're spending, how to control your spending, how to put money aside. But Michael really surrounded himself with a lot of yes people, and that's because he did not want to hear no.
And finally, we only have about a minute left. We understand that Michael's mother, Catherine Jackson, won temporary guardianship of his three children and temporary control of his estate. So I'm just curious, what financial issues will she have to deal with over the course of time? One does not know whether he left a will assuring who would take care of the children in the event something happened to him. So are there issues, again, that the rest of us should be thinking about when we think about a situation like that?
Yes, when you have children, you need to make sure that you leave a will telling who you want to receive your children. Otherwise, it's up to the courts. And the good thing for the children, however, is that Michael is no longer spending. So with that, I'm sure the cash flows from the estate will return positive very quickly.
All right. Alvin Hall is a regular contributor on matters of the economy and personal finance. He joined us from our bureau in New York. Alvin, thank you. Welcome back. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, Michelle.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. The state of Illinois is embroiled in yet another political scandal. This one involves the University of Illinois. There are allegations that students with political clout were admitted to the school over other more qualified applicants. NPR's David Shaper reports from Chicago.
When he graduated from high school 3 years ago, William Jones thought he had done what he had to do to get into the University of Illinois that fall.
I was mostly an AA student, A with a couple Bs. I got a 29 on my ACT. So when I originally applied to U of I, I guess I cockily thought I was a shoo-in, but apparently not.
Jones scored high enough to get on Illinois' waiting list before ultimately being denied. Plan B was to go to the University of Iowa, where he paid out-of-state tuition.
It's almost double the cost.
Jones was able to transfer to Illinois after 2 years. Standing outside a summer class he's taking at the U of I's Chicago campus, he says his struggle on the wait list and difficulties transferring didn't bother him at all, until he saw recent newspaper stories revealing that the University of Illinois keeps a so-called clout list, and that prospective students with powerful sponsors were often admitted over more qualified applicants.
The fact that I was on this waiting list of short people makes me feel like I was really screwed, actually. It means that I was this close and you know, just on the border of getting in, and I didn't. And I got a feeling that if that clout list didn't exist, I probably would have gotten into U of I originally.
University of Illinois officials now acknowledge they actually created a special classification to track the applications of students with clout called Category I. The university's former associate director of admissions, Abel Montoya, testified Monday before a special state commission investigating the scandal. And he says his decisions to deny admission to certain unqualified Category I applicants were sometimes overturned.
I asked, why in the world are we admitting this kid that's so low? And my director told me.
Montoya explained how the Category I system worked. Each office on the campus that deals with influential people, whether it be donors, alumni, or politicians, had a designated liaison who would let him know whenever a powerful someone would inquire about a particular applicant. He says he would then mark that applicant's file as Category I, and he made sure the file's label reflected that applicant's clout, too.
A red stripe would go through the middle so it'd stand out from other applications.
There may have been more than 150 red-striped applications a year out of more than 25,000 university applications overall. And in the highly competitive college admissions game, that red stripe was often the extra little push a borderline student may have needed to get admitted. The University of Illinois' top lobbyist, Richard Schell, testified he often inquired about the status of certain applicants on behalf of lawmakers and other public officials, and he admits occasionally noting just how important some of those officials were within state government. But Schell denies those public officials threatened to withhold funding from the university if a particular student didn't get in, and he denies trying to get unqualified students admitted.
I never said to anybody, you must take this kid, but I do agree, as I look back, the appearance of that or just the role I have could have compromised the situation.
A University of Illinois spokesman says the school is cooperating with the investigation. Federal authorities are looking into what role former Governor Rod Blagojevich and top fundraiser Tony Rezko may have had in clouting students into the U of I. And while Illinois is not alone in having the rich and powerful trying to influence public university admissions, experts say the scale to which it appears to be done in Illinois puts the state in a class by itself. It remains unclear if the University of Illinois' clout list broke any state laws or school policies. The commission will continue its investigation into August when it is due to report its findings to the governor. Regardless of the outcome, the once-denied 21-year-old William Jones, who will be a senior at the U of I in the fall, says he is getting something out of it.
I'm starting to learn it's more about who you know. It's not about how hard you work. It's not about necessarily how intelligent you are. It's about who you know, the connections you have.
Call it a free lesson in Illinois Politics 101. David Shaper, NPR News, Chicago.